Precautions to be taken by the banker. The company borrows only for the purpose as mentioned in the memorandum of association. If the purpose is not mentioned in the memorandum of association, a banker cannot lend money to the company. Say, for example, the company is in the business of producing textiles, and if the company wants to borrow money for an electronic plant, the company cannot borrow and the banker cannot lend, because textile is specifically mentioned in the memorandum of association. The bank has no business to give any loan to the company for establishing an electronic project. So that has to be carefully seen from the memorandum of association. A certified copy of resolution of the board of directors passed under section 292 of the Companies Act has to be obtained by the banker. We have seen the importance of the copy of board resolution. It mentions the name of the banker with whom the company will be banking. It mentions the name of the persons who are authorized to operate the bank account. Hence, the copy of board resolution becomes a very important document, so that is how the banker takes the directions directly from the board as to the operations and the opening of account. The board of directors should also pass a resolution certifying that the company's borrowing, including the proposed borrowings, are within the limit specified by the Companies Act, we have seen section 293, or the limit sanctioned by the shareholders at the general meeting. So shareholders at the general meeting have also an authority to sanction the borrowing limit of the company, and hence such documents also become handy for the banker to decide on the borrowing limit of the company. The account opening form for opening an account has to be duly filled by the company, duly signed by all the authorized officials of the company. Specimen signatures of all the directors, authorized persons to operate the account should be obtained and verified. Certified and updated copy of the Memorandum of Association and the Articles of Association to be obtained, not only obtained, but it needs to be verified with the registrar of the company if necessary, if there is any doubt or non-clarity in the Memorandum of Association and the Articles of Association, because the registrar of the companies will be the best person to direct about what exactly the inclusions in the Memorandum of Association and the Articles of Associations are in case of a doubt. Certified copy or the certificate of incorporation issued by the registrar of companies to be obtained. In case of public limited company, the copy of commencement of business also needs to be obtained. Updated list of directors should be taken each year, signed by the chairman. So the updated list of directors should be taken each year, duly signed by the chairman. This is very essential because there may be several inclusions or the retirement or exclusions of directors. The banker has to take into account all those inclusions and exclusions of directors through an updated list, which has to be duly signed by the chairman. You have to take a certified copy of resolution of the board of directors regarding, number one, the opening of account, number two, the execution of account, and number three, the conduct of account. Once you have this, you have a clear clarity of how the company is going to deal with the banker relating to the account opened with the bank. That's not enough, because whatever information is submitted by the company while opening an account is a static information. As the company grows or as the company does its productions and operations, the financial figures are going to change. And whatever the facility that is granted by the banker to the company is based on the progress or the assets of the company. Hence, it is very essential that the copies of financial statements has to be produced from time to time before sanctioning and permitting drawdowns of loans. Once you have the latest statements, financial statements, the company will be actually put into size, and based on that, the various facilities that can be sanctioned by the bank to the corporate can be decided from time to time. In case of winding up, the checks drawn by the directors or the authorized officials subsequent to the commencement of winding up should not be paid. So once the winding up order has come, the checks drawn subsequent to the winding up should not be paid and should be returned to whomever it is marked to. In case of a firm which has got converted itself into a private limited company and has applied for an advance, now you understand this scenario. It's a firm which has converted itself into a private limited company. When we talk about the firm, the liability of the partners of the firm are unlimited, and the moment it gets converted into a private limited company, the liabilities format changes from unlimited to maybe a limited. In that case, if an advance has to be given by the bank to such converted firm into a private limited company, the banker has to take utmost care to protect its interest. And what is to be done? The entire details of the creditor's claim and the company's assets transferred from the firm has to be checked. The banker has to check whether there are any encumbrances established on the firm's assets, whether the assets that are shown are in good shape or are in an inflated manner, because any inflation is not going to project the correct financial health of the company, and hence there may be a disguise and the banker may not be in a position to sanction the loans based on the real assets. Once the loans are sanctioned, it is important to register the charge on the company's assets. So registration of charges has been mentioned, the process of registration of charges, which type of charges needs to be registered are mentioned under section 125 of the Companies Act 1956. Every charge must be registered with the Registrar of Companies within 30 days of its creation. If the banker fails to register the charge within 30 days of its creation, then it has to face the consequences of failure to register the charge, which we are going to see in the next slide. So the first requirement for registration of charges is it has to be registered with the Registrar of Companies within 30 days of its creation. A charge for the purpose of securing any issue of debentures. So this is the first type of charge that needs to be registered with the ROC within 30 days. The second type of charge is a charge on any immovable property or any interest therein. The third type of charge is a charge on any book debts of the company. The fourth type of charge is a charge not being a pledge on any movable property of the company. So, a charge not being a pledge on any movable property. Please note, it's not being a movable property, a charge not being a pledge on any movable property. Hence, the third point says a charge on any immovable property. So we are not talking about pledge on a movable property. A charge on the calls made but not paid. So these are the various types of charges the bank has to note and has the responsibility of registering with the ROC. The next type of charge which needs to be registered is a floating charge on the undertaking or any property of the company, including the stock in trade. A charge on the ship, if the company owns a ship, so a charge on the ship or any share in the ship needs to be registered with the ROC. A charge on the goodwill. Now this goodwill, even though it's intangible, but it can be estimated. So a charge on the goodwill, a patent or a license under a patent, a trademark or a copyright or a license under the copyright also needs to be registered. We have a famous case of Sri Meenakshi Mills versus the Registrar of Companies. The Registrar of Company had contended that the amount of fixed deposit was a book debt of the company. So the amount of company was a fixed deposit was a book debt of the company, and so a charge created thereon was required to be registered. The point was whether fixed deposits, a charge on fixed deposits needs to be charged with a charge creation with the ROC. The company argued. Company said the transaction was a pledge and hence need not be registered, because we had clearly seen in section 125 a charge on not being a pledge on any movable property of the company. So a charge not being a pledge on any movable property pledge need not be registered. So on that basis, the company argued that the transaction was a pledge and hence it was a pledge for a movable property and hence need not be registered. The High Court considered the arguments of both the Registrar of Companies as well as the company, and the High Court held that a fixed deposit would also be considered as a movable property if the company would be could treating the transaction as a pledge, avoid registration of the charge. It was not necessary for it to register the charge merely because it could also be registered as a charge on a book debt. So this decision went in the favor of the company, who considered it as a pledge of a movable property, and hence the company's argument was upheld, and hence the court decided this matter in favor of the company. So friends, we have to very clearly understand what type of asset is considered for creating a charge and whether creation of charge is necessary as per section 125 of the Companies Act 1956, and if it is necessary, then it has to be registered within 30 days of its creation with the Registrar of Companies. If it is not done, then it attracts certain consequences which we'll be seeing in the next few slides. What does section 126 say? Where any change on any property of a company has been registered, or where a charge on any property of the company is registered under section 125, what happens after that? Any person acquiring such property shall be deemed to have the notice of the charge as the date of its registration and not from the date of its creation. Suppose a charge is created on the first of a month, whereas a charge is registered on the 25th of the month. As per this section, a person is supposed to know about the charge as registered under section 125 from the date of creation, from the date of its registration and not from the date of its creation. So we have various case laws based on this, and as a banker, you have to be absolutely clear what is the date of registration for charge, and hence a search has to be made at the ROC office to to check whether there are any charge registered on the company's assets. If there are no charge registered on the company's assets, then the banker can go ahead with the sanction of loan. But if there are any charge registered on the company's assets, then the banker may not have a right to create a security on the charge assets. That is one of the biggest consequences of failing to see the charge in the company's assets. What happens when a charge which was to be created is not created? So failure or non-registration of charges attracts certain consequences. What are they? The first and the foremost thing that will happen is it will render the charge void against the liquidator and any creditor of the company so far as any security on the company's property is conferred by the charge. Only if the charge is registered, then only the creditors will have a right for setting that property against the loan, else it won't have any such right because the charge itself will be created as void. It does not mean that a transaction itself becomes void. The loan execution or whatever the facility given will remain live. The transaction won't become void, or the debt is not recoverable. The debt would also be recoverable. But the problem here is a suit cannot be filed against the assets which are not charged in favor of the bank. The non-registration of charge shall have the effect that a security created by it becomes void as against the liquidator and also against the creditors. Such debts becomes unsecured one. That means even though on paper you have taken the recordings or the details of the property as security, but in real execution or selling or disposing of the property for adjusting the outstanding in the loan account won't be possible, and simply such debt will be considered as unsecured one. It won't be secured by the company's assets, even though it was decided to have those company's assets as a security for sanctioning such loans. What happens in case of a winding up? For the want of registration under Section 125, it would affect the holder of an unregistered charge in case of winding up proceedings, and that too against an official liquidator. So the charge won't hold good when the winding up proceedings are taken up, especially when the charges are not registered as required under Section 125 of the Companies Act 1956. Such a holder of an unregistered charge would not be entitled to claim a preferential right. He will have to stand behind the preferential holders, and hence he won't be having a preferential rights because the charge was not registered. As long as the company was a going concern, the unregistered charge would not become void as against the unsecured creditors, because the company is still running. This issue will come only in case of a winding up, and hence this point has to be carefully noted by the banker, especially the consequences of non-registration of the charges. And the first thing the bank has to do even before disbursement is to have the charge recorded with the register of companies, so that whatever security that is offered by the company is adequately secured for the loan that is going to be advanced by the bank to the company. Now we are going to check what would be the effect when the mortgagee has obtained a decree, whether non-registration of charge is going to give some benefit to the mortgagee of a decree. The consequences of non-registration of charge under Section 125 continue even if the mortgagee has obtained a decree prior to the issue of order of the winding up of the company. Hence, it is very essential to note that registration of charge is very important as required under Section 125 of the Companies Act 1956, even if the mortgagee has obtained a decree prior to the issuer order of winding up of the company, the consequence of non-registration of charge will continue and has to be strictly noted. What should be the banker doing as far as its dealing with the corporates? The banker has to ensure that a charge over the assets of the company created in his favor is duly registered with the ROC within the prescribed period, which is 30 days. The registration of charge safeguards the interests of the creditors, including the bankers, and specifically in case of defaults in repayment of the loan, the banker has to take a decision of disposing the assets by filing a case in the court or by some special rights, especially under the Surfacy Act, only and only if the registration of charge is made, only and only then it will safeguard the interest of the bankers for any loan advanced to the company against the security of its assets. Now, there are different types of charges that a banker can create or any lender can create. Generally, banker creates floating charge, fixed charge based on the type of assets. Bankers grant secured loans on the basis of fixed charge on the fixed assets of the company. So, fixed charge can be created on the fixed assets of the company, whereas a floating charge will happen over the stock in trade or the book debts and other movable assets, which are bound to change as the company does its day-to-day operations. Sometimes, in addition to the above, a personal guarantee is also secured from the directors of the company as a collateral security. A banker should be careful about any prior charge because any prior charge will be diluting the charge made by the banker on a fresh loan given by it to the company. Hence, a banker should carefully note about any prior charge and accordingly take action for creating a fixed charge or a floating charge, or for that matter, even obtaining a personal guarantee for securing the loan given to the company. Precautions regarding a prior charge over the assets of the company. If the debentures are secured by a floating charge over the assets of the company with a stipulation that a company cannot create any other charge over the assets ranking above at par with the charge in favor of the debenture holders, and in spite of if the banker goes ahead, then it will have to face the consequences. Charge by the company subsequently will therefore not have a priority on the earlier charge. So the banker has to specifically check this condition. If it is, it should not go for creation or it should not accept the security. The banker should therefore be very careful in finding out the existence of any prior charge over the assets of the company by inspecting the register of charges or the ROC, register of companies. This is very important, and only after opting a confirmation there is no prior charge, it should go for advancing any facility to the corporate. Every company is required to maintain at its register office a register of charges, and this is also an easy source of examining whether there is any prior charge existing by checking the register of charges, which is generally placed at the registered office of the company. What are the other books that need to be inspected? A banker should also inspect the register of mortgages and the charges maintained at the office of the Registrar of Joint Stock Companies, which contains the details of the charge registered under Section 125 of the Companies Act. This particular detail will help the banker to check any prior charge and accordingly decide upon what is the quantum of security that will be available for the banker if at all any loan is given to the company. What about the director's personal accounts? If a director who is authorized to operate the company's account deposits checks drawn in favor of the company to his personal account, the banker must make an inquiry in such a case, because a personal account of a director generally should not have a credit of a check which is in favor of the company. And if at all any such thing happens, the first thing the banker has to do has to inquire with the company as to why such checks in name of the company are directed in the personal account of the directors. If the credit is made in the personal account of the director despite the unsatisfactory reason, then the banker shall be liable to refund the money credited to the director's account. Hence, a banker should be absolutely clear as to the real reasons, and some sort of confirmation has to be obtained from the authorized officials of the company for doing such credit. Otherwise, the banker shall be liable to refund the money credited to the director's account. Additional precautions has to be taken in case of the private limited companies. Bankers should be very careful in advancing the loans to a private limited company which has recently been incorporated by conversion of business of a sole trader. The constitution of a sole trader will be more on the individual basis, whereas the moment it goes into the conversion, the constitution is changed. Hence, the banker should be very careful in advancing loans to a private limited company which has recently been incorporated by conversion of the business of a sole trader. In such cases, the creditor of the sole trader cannot recover their dues from the company which is deemed to be an entity separate from its shareholders. So whenever it's a sole trader, he is generally individually liable, but the moment the constitution has been changed in the corporate, the sole trader constitution is changed, and hence the creditors of the sole trader cannot recover their dues from the company which is deemed to be the entity separate from its shareholders. Such transfer of asset is considered to be an act of insolvency, and the insolvency proceedings may be instituted against such persons. So banker has to take additional precautions in case of private limited companies, especially when the conversion from the sole trader to the corporate happens. Now we move on to one more constitution of a different type of customer, which can be clubbed into clubs, societies, charitable institutions, libraries, schools, etc. All these come under one umbrella, as these are governed by the bylaws of the respective entities. They are not engaged in trading activities maintaining their accounts with banks. So these particular entities are not specifically dealing with trading. They are established for some purpose which is not a trading purpose, and hence banks should observe the following precautions. What are they? The applicant society should be properly registered under the Societies Registration Act 1860. It has to be incorporated under Companies Act 1956. We remember that Section 25 companies, no profit, no loss companies. So if at all the constitution of this entities are in the form of company and requires registration under Companies Act 1956, a unregistered society cannot be sued. And hence, whenever opening of account of such entities are undertaken, we have to check whether they are registered or unregistered, and if they are registered, we have to take details of the registration done under the Societies Registration Act 1860 or under the Companies Act 1956. A banker should obtain a copy of bylaws which is a very important document of all these entities. Because this bylaws will have all the rules and regulations, the purpose for which it has been established, the operations or the deposits that can be permitted by such entities with the bank, and hence all this throws light on the dealings a banker is permitted with this type of entities. Hence, the banker should obtain a copy of bylaws of the society and acquaint himself with the powers and functions of the persons managing the affairs of these entities. The banker should also obtain a copy of resolution of the managing committee. Most of these entities have a managing committee, and hence whatever the decision of the managing committee is captured in the form of a resolution, and hence it is very essential for a banker to obtain a resolution of the managing committee for appointing the bank concerned as a banker and authorizing the person to the operations of the account and giving any directions of the operations of the account. The banker also needs to ascertain the borrowing powers of the society from its charter or memorandum. The purpose for which the borrowing is permissible also needs to be established and must be noted, and the powers of the managing committee or its office bearers has to be carefully checked to create a charge over the assets of the society, and all inquiries necessary has to be made before entering into any dealings with the societies. In case of death of the authorized person, the banker should stop the operation of the society's account till the society nominates another person to operate its account. The banker is under an obligation to ensure that the funds of the society are not being credited to the personal account of the directors or the authorized persons. If the banker is guilty of negligence, it will not get the statutory protection available under Section 131 of the Negotiable Instruments Act 1881. So friends, we are on the conclusion page. After having understood various types of customer a banker is going to deal, what is the message we have to take out of this lesson? Banking institution solicits deposits of money from the public. Hence, it has a big responsibility of taking care of the deposits taken from the public. It is important to remember that the deposit accounts can only be opened for those persons who are legally capable of entering into a valid contract. And how do we decide about the capability of persons who are eligible to enter into a contract with the bank? This can be decided after obtaining the required documents based on the constitution. We have seen the different types of documents required by the individual. We have seen the different types of documents that are required from non-individuals, like the trust, the partnership firms, the corporates, the Hindu undivided families, etc. Hence, unless those required documents, those mandatory documents are obtained from those entities, there won't be a valid contractual agreement, and hence it becomes very essential to first know what are the documents that need to be obtained from such entities. And once you know, it is utmost necessary to obtain those documents and preserve it till the account is running with the bank. Both individuals as well as non-individuals have to interact with the banker based on the constitutions or the features of their entity. As we say, the authority is neither more nor less than what is actually mentioned in the authority documents. And the banker has to strictly follow and not to give any more or any less than what is mentioned in the authority documents. And hence, this applies for both the individuals as well as the non-individual accounts. And the constitution of the account is very important for deciding what dealings the banker will have with such entities. Banker should always be aware of the various constitutions of both individuals as well as non-individual customers for whatever facility is going to offer. Whether it is a deposit facility, whether it is a fund-based facility, or whether it is a non-fund-based facility, any facility can be given with a contractual agreement, and any contractual agreement requires capable persons to enter into a contract, and when it comes to capability of persons, the capability will be decided on the basis of the Constitution, and whatever documents are mandated on the basis of Constitution has to be obtained, and every banker has to strictly follow. If it does not follow it, we have seen the consequences of failure to obtain certain documents. You lose the right of suing, the charge that is created becomes void, and the consequences are serious. It ends up into non-recovery, failure of loans, and the best thing is to follow the rules rather than face the consequences of not obtaining the documents. Thank you very much. This ends chapter 12.